Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us once again on Queensbury Rules Radio. I'm Patrick Conner of QueensburyRules.com, and on the line here I also have James Foley of BadLeftHook.com. James? Hello? Yeah, well, he's not answering, that's fine. Well, as some of you may have noticed, I changed up a little bit of the intro music there. Maybe just temporary, I guess we're just checking it out, but I figured we would see how well it went. But we have, of course, for me, a big week of boxing discussion, being that I'm a huge Johnny Gonzalez fan, as many of you know. But James should be joining us here momentarily. But also today on the show, we're going to be joined by William Detloff, who is a former writer for Ring Magazine and also now... there's James. Sir.
Here I am. Can you hear me?
There you are, dude.
All right.
I can. I was just letting everybody know that we're going to be joined by William Detloff in a couple minutes here, and it should be a fun show today.
It's exciting.
Yeah, exciting stuff for sure. But needless to say, over the weekend, the talk of the weekend was Johnny Gonzalez's huge upset KO over Abner Mattes in less than a round. I mean, we're going to get to that later a little bit more after we... probably with Detloff a little bit too, but I mean, seriously, you know I'm a huge Johnny Gonzalez fan, so
yeah,
just kind of, you know, help me out here because I'm a little lost for words. I might tear up.
You had to be pretty excited about that.
Yeah, it was go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, kind of, you know, we always say, well, the guy's a monster puncher, so he's, you know, he's got a chance, and this was the case where that played out.
Yeah, and I mean, I saw a couple people say that they saw 10-1 odds, 12-1 odds. I saw one person say they saw 15-1. I mean, any way you slice it, I know that those don't really sound like huge odds, but those are pretty big odds. I mean, especially when you're looking at a... Well, I mean, Johnny Gonzalez going into the fight wasn't a complete bum or anything like that, but I think that it also speaks to how people were viewing Abner Mattes going into that fight.
Yeah, well, coming off the De Leon win, you know, it was hard not to make Mattes a big favorite over Gonzalez. But, you know, what can you say? I mean, the guy kind of was pawing at him for 2 minutes and just totally set him up and hit him with a huge punch, hurt him, got the stoppage. We'll probably debate that a little bit more later. I wasn't a huge fan of the way that it was stopped, but, you know, what can you say? I mean, Gonzalez
earned
the win.
Well, I think that one of the guys who's kind of stuck by that viewpoint, and I think does have a legitimate point, is Eric Raskin, who we had on the show. But basically, he was saying essentially that if it hadn't gotten stopped the way that it was stopped, at the very least, there wouldn't really be a whole lot to argue about. And so I tend to agree with that. I wasn't, you know, huge on the way that it was stopped. But, I mean, I think that there's kind of another point of view, which is that Abner was given, you know, a bit of a break on the first knockdown. I mean, not a break, but, you know, he was given a couple extra seconds. But then again, that also made it kind of inconsistent. So,
well,
yeah,
it kind of defeats the purpose of the ten count to call it off like that.
Yeah,
with the guy's not unconscious and seemingly on his way up. You know, you certainly could have gotten more information. I mean, if he stood up and fell down, or if his legs wobbled, or you know, whatever. But it just seemed kind of lame. I mean, he immediately protested it. Usually, that's a good sign that the fighter was in condition to continue. And obviously, there was a lot at stake for Mattes, but maybe it's like hypocritical after, you know, we're talking about Taylor, Chavez Taylor, and I, you know, kind of agree with Richard Steele there because I don't think Mattes was in as bad of shape as Taylor was, you know, but he got knocked down twice. I mean, he got knocked down and hurt really badly, and he couldn't stand up, and he went down again. So I think referees nowadays, they're not giving as much leeway.
Well, I think that there's some room to kind of look at it on a case-by-case type of thing. You know, just because you think that one stoppage is too early doesn't mean that you have to, you know, apply that type of logic across the board. Because, I mean, not long ago, we were just talking about the Derek Chisora versus Malik Scott fight. And, you know, I think that while it's kind of a similar situation, at least with the count, you know, they're two different fights, two different situations, and yeah. Well, anyway, I think that Mr. Detloff just jumped on here. Do you know his prefix, by the way?
I don't.
That's all right. Then I'm going to assume this is him. Mr. Detloff.
Hi, this is Larry Merchant.
You said that a little too fast to be Larry Merchant.
Ah, that's true. I'll slow it down next time.
How's it going, sir?
It's going very well. How's it going with you guys?
Great.
Good.
Thanks for coming
great.
On, man.
It's my pleasure. We all sound very excited to have you, don't we?
Exactly.
Well, so we were basically just diving right in with the talk from last weekend. How big of an upset was that Johnny Gonzalez win over Abner Mattis in your point of view?
Well, it was very big. Mattis was being seen as the pound-for-pound guy, as you guys know. I think it was a huge surprise to most everybody but our lovely and talented Eric Raskin, who, if memory serves, almost picked Mattis during our own podcast, Ring Theory. I don't mean to get a plug in already. I think it's just referring back to that discussion that Eric and I had. I think he almost picked Jahani to beat Mattis, but he decided at the last second not to. But yeah, it was huge. It was very big. I certainly didn't think that he was going to win. After he was pretty terrible against Ponce de Leon in his last fight, I thought we weren't going to hear too much from involved, especially against a top guy like Abner Mattis.
Now, Bill, I think you were a little bit upset about this. Well, not upset, but didn't seem particularly fond of the stoppage either. Do you want to elaborate about that?
Yeah, sure. And it wasn't even just that stoppage in particular. It's what we're seeing a lot over and over in fights, big and small, and it's really the abolition of the 10 count. What we're seeing, I think, a lot is referees who are hesitant to finish counting a guy out, reaching 10, which is really a fundamental and basic rule of boxing. You have until 10 to get up. They just look at the fighter and assess him quickly and decide that it's not worth giving the full count, stop the fight. And recently, of course, we saw another example where a guy, a referee stopped counting at 9. Malik Scott was the fighter in question. He was down and got up at 9 and a referee stopped the fight. As he was getting up, he said he counted 9 without even reaching 10. So really, we're seeing referees who I think aren't using the 10 count the way they're supposed to. And Jack Rice was guilty of that in the Mattis-Gonzalez fight, or the Gonzalez-Mattis fight, because he stopped counting at 4 during that second knockdown and told Abner to stay down. And I see no problem with counting to 10, and if he can't get up, the fight is over. And if he can get up, then you can assess the guy then. And Reese chose not to do that. So I was kind of bummed. It may not have made a difference at all, or it might have made a huge difference. The round was almost over. There were about 12 seconds left in the round, as I recall. So it's possible, in fact, likely, that Gonzalez wouldn't even have landed another punch, and Mattis would have had a full-minute rest between rounds to gather himself. Might not have mattered, but it might have, and especially in a big fight like this. Since every fight is a world title fight these days, even given those circumstances, this is a fairly big fight on a fairly big stage, and in an important fight like that, the fighter should get the benefit of the doubt. And it doesn't matter to me, by the way, that Mattis didn't seem particularly upset about the fight having been stopped. That's irrelevant to my view.
Yeah, I think
Oh,
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say...
Somebody go ahead.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of, like Tim Bradley against Provodnikov. I mean, by the same standard, you know, Bradley was probably hurt worse than Mahrez in the first round or the second round. And,
exactly.
You know, we don't know exactly how it would have played out, but anything is possible. Mahrez could have come back, recovered, outboxed him, gotten a decision. He could have come back, knocked him out, or maybe it would have turned into a brutal war like Bradley and Provodnikov. And one thing I think is kind of interesting is, you know, personally, I mean, I think Mahrez can definitely bounce back from that. I don't see, you know, it's obviously going to be another year or so because of the way fighters fight so infrequently these days. But because he didn't end up, you know, because he did kind of get out of it not that badly hurt, you know, it's easier to look ahead to his career prospects. Where I look at a guy like Bradley, and who knows how he's going to look against Marquez after the, you know, horrible beating that he just took in his last fight.
Well, that's what fighters do, though. This is the game they're in, and this is the sport. Sometimes you're going to take a beating, and that's the way it is. That's what the fans want to see, certainly. It's not good for one's long-term cognitive abilities, but you don't get into boxing to live a long, healthy life with lots of high IQ activities. At least you shouldn't, in my view. And the other, I hate to make it sound as though it's only contemporary referees who act like this, but I'm sure there are many examples in the past where referees stopped fights, or got into the habit of stopping fights sooner than people would have liked. But it looks to me these days as though as soon as a fighter gets hurt, and this is going to sound odd, the moment a fighter gets hurt in the ring, a referee is looking for an opportunity to stop it, with a few exceptions. There's Steve Smolder, of course, the great Steve Smolder, who likes a guy's gray matter to be on the canvas before he stops a fight. And the other referee who did a fight recently on one of the undercard fights on Showtime recently, where he let the fight go, which seemed like almost too long in my view, but in that case it wasn't bad because there weren't any great punishment inflicted. I guess my point, getting back to your point, is what was your point? Oh, yes, that Mahrez might recover. Mahrez might recover better and more quickly now than he would have had he gotten a sustained beating. That's probably a valid point. But this is the sport fighters choose, and the living they choose, the trade they choose, and this is the way it is.
Well, what do you make of nowadays with the TV rights? You know, like a lot of these fighters won't fight unless they get a big kind of Showtime or HBO payday, and so they're fighting, you know, much more infrequently, maybe two or three times a year. And this idea of how nowadays it seems like, one, you know, an undefeated fighter, it's like that one loss is so damning to their career, and it takes them a year or a year and a half to actually build back up to get to the same level that they were before.
It can be. It probably, you know, it depends on the nature of the loss and the opponent. I don't think this will hurt Mahrez at all because he's got connections. Gonzalez is a very respected guy with a quick fight. I don't think anybody would be shocked if he came back and beat Gonzalez in a rematch. So for him and top-level guys like him, I don't think it's a big deal. And we're seeing some guys, especially the Eastern European guys lately, who are fighting a lot. Look at Golovkin is fighting every couple months. And we're seeing a little bit more of that lately. And I think that's good, of course. The more fighters go about doing business, the better it is for them and for us. So I don't think that'll be a big deal for Mahrez to rebuild. Again, it was a quick fight, like you pointed out, and maybe, again, that'll work in his favor. But I'll tell you what would have worked better, more in his favor, is if he could have gotten out of it, weathered the storm, or even if he had gotten the opportunity to weather the storm, to come back and made a good fight out of it or won. That would be even better. But we'll take it as it is.
Well, with this so-called abolition of the 10 count, as you were saying, do you think that at all might be have anything at all to do with the fact that, in general, boxing just isn't as readily accepted publicly these days?
Are you asking if I think boxing isn't as accepted because fights are getting stopped too quick?
The other way around. Like, do you think that the general perception of boxing declining over time, although it seems to be getting better slowly, but do you think that would have anything to do with, rash of early stoppages?
It's possible. It's possible. I think no commission wants to have sanctioned a fight where a guy is killed, and no referee, with a couple of exceptions, wants to have a fighter killed on his watch or seriously injured or beaten into a coma on his watch. Everybody's very apprehensive about that, which they should be, of course, but this is a dangerous game. And everybody knows that going in. Referees, commissioners, the fighters, everybody knows that. To answer your question, do I think fights are getting stopped quicker these days? So maybe because general sports fans find boxing too brutal. No, I don't think that's it at all. I think on the surface, mixed martial arts appears more brutal than boxing, even though it really isn't. And that's something that's inferred mixed martial arts' popularity.
I think that's a fair point. I mean, as far as, well, I was going to basically ask where you think that a guy like Johnny Gonzalez could go from this point forward. I mean, I know that a lot of the talk has been kind of about, you know, whether or not Abner Matas was overrated going in, et cetera, but,
oh, that's so,
you know,
yeah, that's
the real
so
story obviously should be, where do we go from here with Johnny Gonzalez?
Sure, you could fight any featherweight out there. There's no reason they shouldn't fight anybody. There's no good reason for it. I'd like to see him fight anybody in the division. He could even go up a weight class or two these days, things being what they are. But a rematch with Morris isn't out of the realm of possibility, of course. And I think that's probably the safest bet. Golden Boy will probably get Morris an easy rematch quickly to get, as I tweeted recently, the taste of concussion out of his mouth. And then look for a rematch with Gonzalez, and they'll probably get it. It'll probably be made because Morris is a big name.
Yeah, I think that's probably the plan. Bill, I want to change gears a little bit and ask,
sure.
Do you have any kind of update on your biography of Ezra Charles, and do you want to talk about that? And also, what attracted him to you as a subject?
I'll answer the second one first, if you don't mind. Some years ago, I wrote a long section for The Ring called The Greatest Black Heavyweights of All Time. And in the course of researching that, I came across information that I hadn't previously known, or had known at some minor level. Namely, that as a light heavyweight, Ezra Charles, who is essentially dismissed as a heavyweight champion, as one of the lower tier heavyweight champion, he did some wonderful work at middleweight and especially light heavyweight. Of course, he beat great Archie Moore several times, once by knockout. He beat Joey Maxson four times. He beat, who didn't he beat down there? He beat Jimmy Bivens more than once. He beat Charlie Burley more than once at middleweight. He beat every good light heavyweight and middleweight around at that time. And then by the time he moved up to heavyweight, he was already really out of his weight class and really past his prime almost. So anyway, I discovered all these great things about Ezra Charles and came to the conclusion that he was the greatest light heavyweight of all time. Even though I don't know that anybody had ever called him that or rated him that, even though he never got a shot at the title. So that always stuck in my head. And years later, I realized that as I continued to read and do more research about other fighters, that there had never been a biography written about Ezra Charles. And that seemed like such an injustice to me, because certainly many fighters, not as great as Ezra Charles, have been the subject of biographies. And this is not to denigrate any of those guys. But
yeah, no, I'm working on a Tommy Morrison bio.
Well, there you go. You better hurry up, because I hear he's on his way out. Any day, literally. I don't think anybody has him in the Ring Theory test pool, which is very disturbing. But Muhammad Ali, there must be 100 biographies of Muhammad Ali. Same with Joe Louis, and someone like Tyson. But Ezra Charles, in my view, is probably in the top three pound-for-pound fighters ever. And there's never been a biography written about him. And he's an interesting subject, too, by the way, because you guys are probably a little young to remember this. But in the 80s, it became the in thing in boxing, just a cool, normal thing, to boo the hell out of Richard Steele because of his involvement in a couple of fights, namely the Chavez, Julio Cesar Chavez, another Kala fight, and the Mike Tyson Razor Ruddock fight, both of which he stopped prematurely in the eyes of many. So every time Richard Steele was announced at a fight, he was booed. And that just became the thing to do. And it was kind of the same thing with Ezra Charles. After he beat Joe Louis, no matter what Ezra Charles did, or no matter who he fought, he was booed everywhere by everyone. So that attracted me to him also. He's got kind of a loser story, but he didn't deserve any of it. And he wasn't appreciated at all for what he had done. So that's what attracted Ezra Charles, in my mind, as a subject of biography. And also, like I said, because he never had one written about him before. And also, how is it going? It's going well. I'm told by the publisher that we should expect the book to be released in the spring. Of what year, I'm not sure yet. But he said in the spring, so I'm confident that it will be in the spring.
All right.
That was in the poor 10-10 joke. It was a little bit
no,
of a coming thing next year.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds great, you know, and I think that's one of the most fascinating eras of fight. A lot of those guys in the light heavyweight division back then, like Archie Moore and Jersey Joe Walcott, you know, it seemed like they all kind of moved up to heavyweight and fought some high-profile bouts. And, you know, this, I think the championship went back and forth a couple times before Rocky Marciano came in. But, yeah, that's a great era to write about just in general. And I think Ezard's going to be a fascinating subject. So we're all looking forward to it.
I am, too. I'm looking forward to being done as well. And I hope that I can do Ezard justice because, again, he deserves it.
And speaking of your boxing writing, I was just going to ask, do you have any plans to write about anything, any modern or do a column or anything like that?
Not right now, no. I might think about writing a column again online somewhere after the book is done, but I don't think so. I think this might be my last boxing-related writing. My good friend and one of my literary heroes, Nigel Collins, said recently with great accuracy that he doesn't consider himself to be writing boxing. He writes about the human condition, the lens of boxing. And that's a wonderful way to describe good writing about boxing. In my case, I don't think I have anything left to say about boxing that I haven't said or written already. So I think after the Ezra's book, I'll be done.
Well, you can always go for cheap laughs.
That's true. I could, and believe me, they would be cheap. They absolutely would be cheap.
I was just going to say that it was interesting as I was doing research myself for a kind of longer piece that I wrote about Kid Chocolate that I came across an interview with Ezard Charles where he had said that his particularly flashy outside of the ring style was inspired directly from Kid Chocolate. So I thought that was pretty interesting how the eras just kind of seemed to tie together endlessly.
Well, that's one of the stories in the book. When Ezard was about 9 years old, Kid Chocolate came to Cincinnati to try to make the division with a local guy named Johnny Farr. And he was riding in this big convertible through the slums of Cincinnati. And Ezard and a bunch of his boyhood friends and a bunch of other kids in the neighborhood went up around the car. And Kid Chocolate was known for his wonderful wardrobe. He wore suits everywhere and, you know, dressed very fashionably for the time. And somebody in the crowd asked him, "Hey, kid, how many suits you got?" And Kid Chocolate said, "I got 365, one for every day of the year." And as a child at that point, he was probably in rags and was raised in abject poverty, said, "I'm going to do what he does. I'm going to have as many clothes as Kid Chocolate does." And that's what originally planted the seed in his mind that he could make money and buy nice clothes from boxing.
Do you think that, well, kind of branching off of that, do you think that boxing is still a kind of a viable mechanism for folks to be, you know, climbing their way out of poverty these days?
For a precious few, it is, sure. Most guys, and you guys know this, the great, great majority of boxers will never really make any money when you consider all the time they put into it and expenses, even though it's a fairly inexpensive sport to participate in. Most of them won't clear any profit, even at a professional level. But for some guys, it certainly is. You know, some guys, we hear about them all the time. Fighters don't come from middle class or upper class families. So just about every fighter you see on television making $1 million purses came out of the ghetto. But for the great majority, no, it's not really viable for them to think they're going to get rich from doing it. However, it does give them hope for the future, which is probably more valuable than anything for most people, but especially a kid in the ghetto who's got a few choices.
It's a great,
Bill,
you've
made some references on Ring Theory to your own decorated amateur career. So, yeah. But I was wondering if you could tell us about that, and when did you start writing about boxing? And also, in covering the sport, what are some of your favorite fights that you attended and wrote about?
I kind of feel like I was born thinking about boxing. As far as I can remember back, I was interested in it. And I became infatuated or obsessed with it I can recall the exact moment. It was in 1974, shortly before the Muhammad Ali George Foreman fight, and my sister's boyfriend brought over a copy of Sports Illustrated previewing the fight, and there was a picture of George Foreman hitting the heavy bag. And I saw him and said, "That's exactly who I want to be. I want to be that guy." So at that point, I knew I wanted to do it. I wanted to box. Even when I started boxing, I started competitively boxing at about 14. I knew that I was never going to be George Foreman, number one, nor was there ever going to be anything great or even overly successful. But I did it anyway.
Now you can grow like him.
There you go. But I kind of knew that I would be involved in it somehow, and in the back of my mind, I kind of knew that I would be writing about it because I've been reading boxing magazines almost my entire life also. I tell Steve Harder to this day that I learned to write boxing from reading him and also Nasser Collins, a pretty old magazine that used to be so good. But so I started boxing competitively around 14, and I stopped at 18, and then I ruminated over it. And even for a half-assed Golden Glover amateur like myself, I would make a comeback and get my ass kicked to the gym, and that would be okay for a year or two. Then I started doing it again, and I'd get my ass kicked again in the gym and quit again. And then finally, when I was 28, I had one last amateur fight to say, I got to do this either once and for all, and I got stopped, and I said, okay, that'll do it, that's enough, and got it out of my system. So, yes, I fought for, I guess, 4 or 5 years of an amateur.
Well, that's a lot more than a lot of other folks can say.
That's
Do you think that like that amateur career does give you a different perspective on the sport? I mean, well, I guess the obvious answer is yes. But do you think that having that amateur career is necessary for being able to see the sport the way that you do?
No, I don't think it's necessary. There's been lots of great observers of the sport who never got hit in the nose in their life. A.J. Liebling and all those guys, all great writers. Red Smith never took a punch in the face. And, well, Norman Mailer did, I'm sure, and Hemingway did, and all the great writers. Angelo Dundee never fought. He was, you know, one of the greatest trainers ever. But so it's not necessary, and it would be impolite of me to say that my boxing experience gave me some kind of edge over other writers. I just know that I know what I know. That's all I can really say about it. I just know what I know.
Yeah, Bill, and Dundee did great work in George Foreman's comeback.
Yeah, according to the great Dan Rayfield, he certainly did. that was purely a PR move by George to hire Angelo Dundee in his comeback. And,
I was surprised he wasn't cited for his work with De La Hoya and before the Pacquiao fight.
There you go. George was such a great showman that he knew that the press and crowd and his fans would respond to having Dundee in his corner because of Dundee's affiliation with Ali, of course. And even if you watch the old videos of Foreman's comeback fights, when he had Dundee in the corner, the guy that Foreman listened to in the corner was Charlie Shice, who was the shorter black gentleman with the gray hair. He was Foreman's trainer for a long time, and before Dundee came around, and when he wanted real advice in the corner, not bullshit advice, Charlie Shice was the guy he listened to.
Well, hey, you guys just recently, like last week, had the great Larry Merchant on Ring Theory.
Yes. Yep.
And I mean, I pretty much went into a sobbing fit after his final monologue because that was one of the most stirring speeches I've ever heard.
That was great, wasn't it?
Yeah. Where does he fit on the pantheon of your Ring Theory guests?
You know, it's happened several times now that Eric and I have finished with a guest and said, "Oh my God, he was so great. That was so great." And it's happened with Larry, of course, and with Jim Lampley, and with Brian Cheney, and with Max Kellerman. You know, it's easy to get full of yourself sometimes and think that you're this or you're that. Then you speak to somebody who speaks so well and so intelligent and so articulate, and you're just humbled. And I think both Eric and I felt that way with each one of those guys. But maybe more so with Larry than anybody. All those guys I just mentioned, Kenny, Kellerman, Lampley, and Merchant, are just so articulate, smart, that it's just a pleasure to be able to speak and to speak with them. The great thing about Merchant's eulogy about Emile Griffith at the end was that, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but it sounded completely off the cuff. I didn't get the impression that he had written it beforehand, but at the same time, it was phrased so elegantly that it almost had to be written. If anybody can speak that well and elegantly off the cuff, I guess Larry can, and it was stirring. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it was kind of huge how you guys were like, okay, thanks, Larry. And he was like, guys, I have just one more thing. And then
yeah,
he launches it.
This,
yeah, just like the most spellbinding oration of our times.
Yeah,
Nigel was fantastic the last time he was on there, too. And I think he eulogized Emile Griffith.
He did a great job.
As well, and
too.
It was really, really good.
Yeah, Nigel concentrated more, I think, on Emile's fighting ability and his personality and his generosity as a person. But yeah, Nigel's eulogy of Emile Griffith was excellent also, and we just like.
Yeah, we're served up a slice of that humble pie pretty much every time we have a guest on. But
As am I. We have to get some really
speaking of which,
that you guys have done this week. Yeah.
Well, we've been getting pretty much just about every guest that we have on. We've been trying to get their take on the upcoming, of course, Floyd Mayweather versus Canelo Alvarez fight. So what's your take on that? Spill it out on us.
Okay, I see a fairly, I don't want to say easy, but a fairly comprehensive win for Floyd Mayweather. That's not to denigrate Canelo at all. Canelo's pretty good. And it's very hard to picture anybody beating Floyd at this point unless the bottom suddenly drops out from underneath him, which I really don't see happening. It happens to everybody eventually, but we're still waiting for it to happen. Bernard Hopkins and Juan Manuel Marquez, older guys who are older than Floyd is. And Floyd has certainly kept himself in great condition all these years. I don't see the bottom dropping out of him right now, which is what I think, again, would have to happen in order for him to lose to Canelo. Canelo's a good fighter. I like him. I always have, but he's not the special kind of guy, I think, that will beat Floyd Mayweather. And it's likely that that guy doesn't exist right. So I like Mayweather, but certainly not by knockout, by decision. I would say, by the way, also, if you don't mind, that exists, that I think Canelo's best strategy is to fight in a non-aggressive way, the way he fought his last opponent, whose name is skipping me, the guy who beat Cotto.
Trout.
Yeah, it's Austin Trout. He didn't really press Trout very much. He kind of laid back and counterpunched, if I recall. And I think I'd like to see him try that same tactic against Mayweather, because everybody rushes Mayweather. He's built his whole career on guys being aggressive against him. That's his thing, counterpunching and being elusive that way. So I think it might serve Canelo well to try making Floyd come to him, again, like he did in spots against Trout. I think that would be interesting. And if that doesn't work, then it might not, because, again, nobody's really found a strategy that works against Floyd. Then he might try something else. And by the way, I know that people would bristle when they hear that, because I think Jose Luis Castillo should have beaten Mayweather all those years ago, but I don't buy that at all. That Castillo's pressure was entirely ineffective, in my view, in that fight, and the decision was right. So at any rate, I don't think the style has been invented yet that will beat Floyd, so Canelo might try a couple of things.
Well, one last thing, Bill, if I could ask you about. You wrote that article about kind of that your childhood experience and the kid from your neighborhood who was hit by a car. Was that just a project that you'd always been, I mean, it was an amazing piece, and I forget what the name of the website is, so can you plug that, and then just what was the impetus behind that? Was it something you've always wanted to write?
The name of the website is themorningnews.org or tmn.org, and yes, that was something that wasn't so much something that I wanted to write, but I had to get it out and had to write it to. And I hate to use a fucking stupid, oh, can I curse?
Yeah.
Yes, you may.
Look at that, you may. Thank you.
Hey, you just pulled a Tony Thompson.
You're right. Yeah.
Fuck, am I allowed to say that?
Exactly right. Or Kelly Pavlik. Do you mind if I curse? I'll say asinine.
Now you got to say something about breaking somebody's hip.
Exactly. Get my wife out there, I'll break her hip. But anyway, I hate to use this that term closure or that bullshit. But that was something that I didn't really want to write, but I felt I had to write. Because it had been beguiling me for 40 years. and it was just something I had to do, rather than revisiting it every few years. As I wrote in the piece, in order to get rid of that constant revisitation, I had to go examine it again from the perspective of an adult and learn everything I could about it, and then write about it and be done with it. So it was fun to publish, of course, as it always is, and it was fun, great fun, to publish something that did not involve boxing. But more than anything, it was something that it just something I had to do. It wasn't something I wanted to do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it was powerful as hell. And I hope that you can, you know, find other subjects to write about. If it's not boxing, you know.
But there are more articles to come, I think, along those lines, eventually.
Well, Mr. Detloff, we appreciate you giving us your time here on the show. It was an enlightening experience. Needless to say, we were humbled as well.
Okay.
Thanks
a lot.
No, you are our Larry Merchant.
I'm the poor man's Larry Merchant. That works. I'll take that. All right, take care, guys. Thanks.
All right, take it easy. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. You're welcome.
Goodbye. Bye.
Wow, kind of a subdued Detloff, but, you know, ultimate. I love that guy.
Yeah, that was solid stuff, man. That was very solid stuff. Yeah, I liked it. Well,
all right, well, good
again,
night, everybody.
Yep, that's it. Now, we have some other stuff to talk about, but I actually wanted to go ahead and we didn't – I'm an idiot, and I totally forgot to plug the podcast that Detloff and Eric Raskin are on, which is Ring Theory. If you search Ring Theory on Google, it will be one of the first couple links, but I'll just go ahead and tell you the address. It's ringtheory.podbean.com. So check out their show. It's a really, really solid boxing podcast. So check it out. And sorry I didn't plug that earlier.
No,
I totally forgot.
I think you were starting to, and then something happened there, but...
I was starstruck.
Yeah,
let's call it like it is.
Yeah, we
let's
both
just
pretty
call
much
it like it is.
Shrunk in that, but it's hard not to in the presence of a legend.
That's what happens, man. I felt like one of those teenage girls when the Beatles were playing. It was great. I had to put my phone on mute. So anyway, this past weekend, so we already talked about the Johnny Gonzalez KO win over Abner Mates, but in the co-main event, I guess
Patrick,
you could say of that.
Go ahead. Sorry. I was going to just to open that up a little bit more. So what do you think about Mares, you know, going forward here? I feel like, you know, for a guy who just took a knockout loss, I think he can bounce right back, you know? I think this can end up being kind of a one-time thing. He can get back on track and, you know, what do you think? I mean, other than him being kind of small for the featherweight division and obviously not being able to take the power of a monster puncher, but... you know, those things do happen, especially in the real early rounds.
Yeah. And
I think the guy can get back.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't think that, I mean, you know, there's always going to be some type of kind of like revisionist history. You know, when things like this happen, a lot of people start searching for perspective that maybe they should have had before the fight. And, you know, even both of us, as far as I can remember, I know I picked Abner Mates. I thought that he was probably going to win late. I didn't really think that Johnny Gonzalez's legs were going to hold up. I thought that he was going to start fading in the second half of the fight. It just didn't even get there. And so as far as, you know, stoppage losses goes, I would say that, you know, as, you know, William Detloff pointed out, that it really wasn't that damaging of a loss. And, you know, he should be able to come back fairly quickly, although it sounds like he wants to take a break. And I don't blame him at all. He deserves a break. He's had one hell of a schedule. So, you know, if he wants to take a couple months off, I think that Johnny Gonzalez should be looking to get, like, a quick defense or, you know, a non-title fight in the meantime. And I think a rematch just makes sense. The way that it ended, you know, even though I thought it was a slight controversy with the stoppage, it was a controversy. It has been talked about, and, of course, just the shock of it even happening. a rematch makes sense. It does. And so I'm all for that happening. Abnormatis, well, coming from the perspective of a Gonzalez fan, Abnormatis gave him the opportunity, and it's, you know, if we're talking fair, it's only fair to give it back.
Yeah, I don't think this was like a Juanma Lopez, Orlando Salido situation, you know, which was another fight in the featherweight, undefeated guy, you know, kind of seemed like he was on the verge of bigger things, and then, of course, just runs into this really tough guy. I mean, Gonzalez is more vulnerable, and he's, you know, he's a huge puncher, and it happened so fast, and I think Mahrez took, you know, the least amount of damage. But, you know, it opens up the whole division. I mean, it's like last, you know, was 6 months ago or beginning of the year, we all wanted to see Donaire against Mahrez. And, you know, it's like a couple years ago, Amir Khan and Tim Bradley was the huge fight. And just things change and the landscapes are changing. Now, all of a sudden, you know, Rigondo, Santa Cruz, you know, there's other fighters who look like they're kind of rising to the top of that weight area.
Yeah, I mean, the entire division, that region basically just got flipped on its lid the other night. And so, yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy that just the way that things unfold. I mean, maybe Donaire and Abnormatis were a little bit too small for 126. I really don't know. But, I mean, even now, of course, even now, I would still like to see an Abnormatis versus Nonito Donaire fight. I mean, you know, all things being equal, I'd like to see it. Of course, it wouldn't have quite the same type of meaning if it happened now as opposed to, you know, 6 months ago when we were all hoping it was going to happen. But, yeah, it's crazy how things can change with just, you know, two or three fights, the entire landscape of the
division. Right, and I mean, they could flip right back, you know, net by next year.
Yeah, and the longer that this goes, I mean, Johnny Gonzalez is not an old guy, but he's not that young either. So, you know, I'm hoping that for Gonzalez's sake, he doesn't, you know, just kind of stay waiting for Abnormatis, even though that might be better money than, you know, most other things in the meantime. But I'm hoping for his sake he doesn't, because I think that he could use, he could really try to use the momentum in a good way. But yeah, that was pretty much my take on it. So to the co-main event, Leo Santa Cruz. Man, this kid is he's a monster. He's some type of force of nature, for sure. I mean, there have been, I'd say, maybe two fights that I've seen where he hasn't really looked, you know, like the wrecking machine that he has most of the time. But against Victor Terrazas the other night, it was kind of brutal stuff once again. His body punches are absolutely crippling. And then, of course, he fucked up his eye. Just, you know, I made a joke that I think that he might have fucked up Victor Terrazas' eye by hitting him in my body. It was gnarly. So, I mean, as far as Leo Santa Cruz goes, what do you see coming from this guy in the next, I don't know, maybe 6 months to a year? Do you think that he does go up to 126? Do you think that he can go up to 126, you know?
I think so. I mean, he seems like he has a big enough frame to do it, and that's probably where the bigger, you know, money fights are going to be for him, because, you know, he's not going to fight Rigondo for a couple reasons. I mean, even if there wasn't the Cold War, that's probably unlikely that they would do that at 122. You're building a star. You're not going to throw him in with a, you know, a tricky fighter, a guy as good as Rigondo. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think, yeah, the plan's probably to get him up there and then get him in the mix with these guys. You know, with Mahrez, with Gonzalez, you know, he's still got Ponce de Leon as somebody who's, you know, he may fight. I don't know. I mean, but obviously we'll all be tuning in. I mean, he's become one of the most exciting fighters. A guy just like, you know, Golovkin, just so far has just been an unstoppable beast. And
he's can't
miss. He looked, you know, vulnerable and a little bit easier to hit in some earlier fights. But this was probably his toughest opponent to date, and he just blew right through the guy.
Yeah, and, you know, we were talking about this on the show last week, you know, I hate to do the kind of, like, you know, incestuous plugging of last week's show or the week's before show. No, I don't hate to do it, whatever, I'll do it anyway. But we were talking about it last week, and, you know, I felt that Terrazas was a guy that would probably open up a little bit too slowly, and I think that that was kind of the case, but I didn't really expect a bludgeoning like that. I mean, just the combination of, you know, punching power, of course. I mean, I don't think that he's a huge one-punch KO guy, but he definitely hits hard enough to put a guy on notice, especially to the body. But the combination of that power, just the kind of unrelenting pressure, and then, of course, Victor Terraza's eye, it was too much. And, I mean, my question is, against a different type of style than we've seen him against, a guy like, for example, Rigondo, what do you think he's able to do with that style? Because I really don't know, personally. I'd like to see him do well against that style, and it might be a good contrast for that style, but I don't know. What would you see in that fight?
I mean, I would love to see that fight, you know, if not right now. I mean, eventually, if both guys keep winning, I mean, it's a perfect style to test somebody like Rigondo, who's, you know, an older fighter, and I think a guy like Santa Cruz would really make him use his legs a lot more than somebody like Donaire. You'd have to favor Rigondo because, you know, beating Donaire amounts to a lot more than anything that Santa Cruz has done yet. I mean, Terrazas was a really solid fighter and a good fighter and the best opponent of his career. But he's also an older guy who'd come from a smaller weight class himself and, you know, not a in-prime fighter. So, but that's, you know, I mean, that's like a mega fight we're envisioning down the road. I don't think Santa Cruz is ready for that yet. And obviously, you know, the promotional difficulties, although Top Rank doesn't look like it's terribly invested in Rigondo. So, you know, from their point, I mean, they would probably make that fight. But, you know, I obviously don't see Golden Boy doing that. But, you know, should Santa Cruz kind of come out of that bracket against, you know, if he can go to featherweight and beat those guys, and depending on what happens with Donaire and what happens on the Top Rank side, you know, in a year from now or a year and a half, I mean, that, you know, those winners, that might be the next fight that we all want to happen. And maybe things will have thawed by then, and there'll be enough of a mandate to get it done. But, you know, of course you'd have to favor Rigondo if that happened right now.
Oh, that was weird. Sorry about that.
Yeah, what happened?
Got totally disconnected for whatever reason, and then made me enter back in my PIN number to get back in. Oh, well. Anyway, you were saying that Santa Cruz versus Rigondo would be more of a kind of in the future type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I would see it like that. But it's definitely, I mean, it's a classic style matchup, you know, an unrelenting aggressor against a kind of a slick counterpuncher. Usually you favor the counterpuncher there, but if Santa Cruz can keep doing what he's doing and keep, you know, moving up levels, I mean, he's going to be in the discussion as an intriguing opponent for whoever, you know, if Donaire can beat Rigondeaux in a rematch, but whoever comes out of the kind of the Top Rank side of things, you know, a year from now, we'll be looking at the winners of the Golden Boy and Top Rank, and we'll probably want them to fight again, just like we did with Meraz and Donaire 6 months ago.
Well, not to, totally kick a dead horse with a golf shoe and everything, but as far as this Golden Boy versus Top Rank thing goes, at least with Guillermo Rigondeaux, who Top Rank doesn't really seem, you know, that interested in pushing very hard anyway. Do you think that the fact that he doesn't really seem to be on great terms with Top Rank would make a fight like that, you know, more possible than it would otherwise?
Sure. But, you know, Golden Boy's not going to put one of their guys in with him unless they're, you know, that really becomes a super fight. Right now, Rigondeaux doesn't have enough of a fan base, and he doesn't have a network supporting him, so there's not going to be enough money for them to risk, you know, one of their guys against him. But in theory, it does. You know, what really would make it possible is if Top Rank just kind of cuts their ties, which they may do. You know, if HBO is not going to put him on, and they don't seem, you know, they didn't seem thrilled when Rigondeaux won that fight. You know, if he was to become a free agent, Golden Boy would sign him. Then, yeah, I could definitely see that being possible if they think they can promote the guy, which, you know, if a great fighter like that, it should be not that hard to promote. I mean, even if he doesn't have the fan-friendliest style, you know, if he racks up, you know, these kind of big wins, just beat a guy who is, I don't know, everybody's top five pound for pound, you know, he should be getting some attention, you know, but we've talked about that before.
Yeah,
with HBO kind of shunning him, and I didn't believe it when we first heard it, but it looks like that's actually the case. They don't seem interested unless he's fighting Nonito in a rematch.
And what I don't really understand, and I mean, I don't want to
dive
too deeply into
it. Patrick, Sorry
go
to interrupt.
No, no, go ahead.
Actually, didn't the HBO just offer him a fight, though, after all that Go ahead.
I had read a little blurb maybe, I don't know, like 2 or 3 weeks ago that they had offered him a fight against, and I can't even remember who it was, but it was some kind of like mid-level type of opposition.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that either way, he doesn't really seem to be, it's not like they're treating him kind of how it seems like he should be treated after, you know, totally undressing a guy that's, you know, in the top few pound for pound on many people's lists. But what I was going to say was, what I don't really understand is that I understand that they pumped a lot of money into Nonito Donaire with all the, like, you know, Pinoy Power pay-per-views that he either headlined or co-headlined and stuff like that. So I understand it's an investment issue, but at the same time, I don't really feel like they have gotten all that much money back on the investment. Like, you know, the live cards that I've seen with Donaire on them, fans don't really seem that receptive to him in general until the knockout happens, if it happens. You know, he doesn't really seem to be doing a ton of great ratings or anything, so I just don't really understand why it's this kind of a, you know, we'd so much rather have Nonito than Rigondeaux thing, because, I mean, both of them have turned in some kind of crappy performances action-wise, so I don't know, I just wanted to throw that out there, I guess.
Well, I think that they probably saw, you know, what happened with Manny Pacquiao and thought maybe they had another potential superstar on their hands, but obviously those are two completely different stories and also different styles of fighting and, you know, possibly different levels of fighter. Although Nonito has looked like an elite guy, but the Rigondeaux loss is a little bit of an indictment. Just the, you know, effort, how unable he was to deal with anything that Rigondeaux was doing for the first 8 or 9 rounds in that fight.
Well, you know, I had asked the question on Twitter just a couple minutes ago that, you know, if Leo Santa Cruz and Guillermo Rigondeaux fought, who do people think would win? And a guy by the handle of Daft Yank, David, answered back essentially, yeah, he's a funny dude, and he basically answered back that he said that Guillermo Rigondeaux will be appreciated one day and that he'd pick Leo Santa Cruz apart. And so I think that he might have something with the first part, that, you know, maybe someday in the future, Rigondeaux will have a little bit more appreciation for, you know, his style and the way that he goes about things. Maybe not, I don't know, but
that could
happen.
I think
that there is something to that.
People tend, especially like hardcore boxing fans, always tend to favor the guy with the more kind of boxing skills in those type of fights, but, you know, sometimes it goes the other way.
Yeah, of course, and I mean, it wasn't quite the same situation style-wise this last weekend, but 10-1, 12-1, 15-1 odds, that shit happens in boxing. That's one of the reasons why we love it. It's, you know, anything could happen, and I know that's one of those cliche things that people say so often that you want to wring their fucking necks the next time you hear it, but it's true. Anything really can happen, and so that's what we're watching for, is to see what is.
And a lot of times a great pressure fighter can bring out the best and bring out a really exciting performance from kind of a boxer who moves backward, because they force them to really be on their game for 12 rounds, and a lot of times you can get kind of the finest exhibitions of the sweet science in those situations. You know, I mean, like just Chavez against Whitaker type of thing, where Pernell really had to be, you know, have his foot on the throttle the entire 12 rounds to really put on a masterful performance. And sometimes,
well,
you know, the puncher will stalk the boxer down and catch him.
Well, and we were just talking Nonito Donaire, and when he looks good is when a guy is constantly attacking him, basically, and when the opponent doesn't play ball is when he generally doesn't look that exciting. So, yeah. Styles definitely come into play.
And he's an interesting case because he's a boxer counterpuncher with power. So sometimes fighters who get big knockouts are kind of seen as more offensive fighters, but no, Donaire's really not that guy.
Yeah, he's a careful type of guy. He really only opens up when he sees an opportunity to do it, you know, somewhat safely. And we also saw that against Rigondeaux, where he was hesitant because Rigondeaux was hitting him with stuff that he doesn't normally get hit with. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's a style thing, but, yeah, anyways, to my original point, it just seems kind of silly not to want to put a guy like that on, or at least test the waters in some market where it makes sense. But, you know, that's how it goes. Politics, of course. But actually, this last weekend, as far as boxing goes in general, a lot of the stuff was short, or at least the Showtime card was pretty short. But on ESPN2, Friday Night Fights, it wasn't quite as good as last week, but it was solid. But my question is that, you know, the main kind of driving force behind the news, or at least, the media reaction to Friday Night Fights, was that the decision seemed absurd to a lot of people. And basically, for anybody who didn't watch or didn't know, it was Argenis Mendez versus Arash Usmani, and they fought to a draw, although most seemed to feel that Argenis Mendez deserved to win the fight. Did you wind up catching up to that, James?
I didn't catch it because I was out of town all weekend and I forgot to record.
Boom.
It.
Boom! Knew it.
Sorry, but I saw I saw some of the commentary, and I like Usmani, and he gave, Rancis Barthelemy a really tough fight earlier in the season, and a lot of people thought that he could have won that.
Yeah. No, it's funny because we were joking about it, I think, on Friday as I was tweeting about the fights. I don't remember who it was, but someone was joking about whether or not you were watching the fights, and so of course I said,
"Yeah, it sucks
no
because I caught almost every Friday night fights until a month ago when we started joking about it, and then I've missed like the last four in a row, other than the one in Chicago that I went to. So I do feel like kind of a scrub. You know, my boxing head credibility is rapidly, declining.
Dude, if you're not up at 4 a.m., queuing your fight downloads, and you ain't.
Yeah, you gotta watch the New Zealand cards too.
Yeah, no, for sure. And when boxing pops up in Brunei, oh buddy, if you're not watching that shit, I'm cutting you to shreds.
If you can't speak on the Brunei boxing, club show scene, then clearly, you're not a real boxing head.
Well, if you've never fought in Brunei, then you can't speak on it. Everybody knows that. But dude, the Friday night fights card, it was solid.
If you want to talk about that, go ahead. I was just going to say, in general, what did you think? I mean, now the season's over. How do you think the Friday night fight season was overall?
I thought that it was pretty decent. I mean, I pointed it out before, and the way that it seems to go, for whatever reason, it seems to be that, like, the first handful of shows of the season, of the Friday Night Fight season, if you can call it that, are decent and have, like, pretty good names, at least, some type of name recognition or whatever. And then, like, there's this lull that lasts, two or three months. And then the last handful of shows of the season or whatever tend to be, bigger name fighters or bigger name matchups, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been that way for a couple of years. But overall, I watch it pretty much, ever since it's been on the air, I've enjoyed watching Friday Night Fights just because, before my current, profession, I always used to work Monday through Friday, and I would get off work, go grab some beer, sit down, watch Friday Night Fights. And that was just kind of how it is. So, for me, it's just almost like tradition at this point. I'm going to watch it no matter what, but I thought that it was solid. There were some really good fights. That weekend in Chicago, that was an absolutely outstanding card. And, not just an outstanding for Friday Night Fights type of card, but a really good card in general. So, yeah, it's been good.
I'd like to see them do that kind of thing more. Just try to have cards at locations where you're going to actually get a few fans in the audience and kind of build it around a local guy. I know you can't do that all the time, but usually the weakest Friday night fights are the ones where it's kind of a more obscure prospect coming from a country with no connection to where the fight's actually taking place. And it's in, some of these look like they're carnival fairgrounds and, like motels and things like that. And it's just, a lot of these, even these like smaller casino shows on Friday night, you're right. The one in Chicago was great because the fights delivered, but it also had a great atmosphere and a great crowd, and it felt like a bigger kind of an event. And, there's a few shows in the season that do that. But also, this season, the emergence of Todd Grisham.
Yeah, the Grisham powerhouse.
You're stepping into Brian Kenny's shoes, man. That's a tough one.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, no, I mean,
he wasn't the direct successor. So he did have the Ozuna buffer to kind of, you know, but.
Well, even before that, I mean, well, in the last maybe 2 years or so, there have been probably about a half dozen guys who they've tried out. Most of them have been absolutely woeful. Mm-hmm. You know, all
there was that one guy who
those
kept,
guys, but.
Well, there was that one replacement guy after Grisham who kept calling Teddy Atlas a legend.
Well, I think he called
that
like,
happened, right?
You know, a dozen different things a legend or legendary.
Okay.
It was a nice catchphrase and whatnot, but I mean, at least sit in for a few episodes before you start with the catchphrases. Come on now.
Yeah, or
but,
put my
know,
man Brian Campbell in the studio.
That's what I'm saying. That is exactly what I'm saying. Brian Campbell, put that dude in there now, or I stop watching and nobody will care. Now it was a good season, and I enjoy Friday Night Fights, like I said. But if I can't, real quick. This last Friday, I basically just wanted to address what I thought was going on, and it's been pointed out by a handful of people as far as the scoring for Argenis Mendez versus Arash Usmani and what happened or how they thought the fight went. Basically, just a retelling for anybody who didn't watch was that Argenis Mendez kind of looked to be the better skilled guy, moved better, seemed to be landing crisper punches, although Usmani, when he did land, seemed to be landing just maybe a little bit harder, which was, I don't think anybody was that surprised by that. But it certainly looked to me as though Argenis Mendez was outclassing him over the long haul, somewhat closely, but clearly. But what happened was that Teddy Atlas, who was unofficially scoring the fight, scored it, I believe it was 11-1. For Mendez. And so, needless to say, that basically sparked his, after it was declared a draw, that sparked his ire, and he went on another, you know, kind of, can we please just get a national commission type of rant. He also actually did mention the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board, but basically,
again?
Yeah, he did, and I think that he was kind of using that as an impetus to mention it. In any event, it was, I think that him basically going off on a rant kind of influenced the outrage after the decision was read. You know, a lot of people took to Twitter and Facebook and were saying that the decision was outrageous and they couldn't see it that way, et cetera. I thought that it was a relatively close fight. I mean, there were a couple close rounds. If you score them the other way, you could get a draw on my card. So I didn't really think it was that crazy, personally. I don't know what the listeners thought, or, you know, maybe you'll go back and watch it, like, a couple of years from now. Who knows? But, yeah.
I'll probably just buy the DVD from one of those illegal sites online.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just thought that it was a little bit of influence on Teddy Atlas' part. And maybe that was intentional, maybe not. Probably not, because he seems like a fairly straight-up guy. But, yeah, that's what I thought happened anyway.
Any mention of the Atlas-Mike Tyson?
Oh, yeah, actually. That's a good point. I tuned in a little bit late because I had to work, so I went and rewatched it. But they did mention Mike Tyson, of course, was the promoter for the card on Friday. And basically what happened with that was that Mike Tyson was essentially made the, I don't know if you want to say figurehead or whatever, of a promotional outfit that had already existed. And they're kind of retooling it and basically calling it Mike Tyson's promotional outfit. And so he came on and he did an interview with Todd Grisham. And also during an interview that actually I don't remember if it was broadcast on Friday Night Fights, but I saw it online, the interview that is, with Todd Grisham, that basically they had cut to a couple minutes before the interview. And Mike Tyson went over to Teddy Atlas and they, you know, made up as far as we know. So, yeah, they did talk about it a little bit, and I guess that's significant. Teddy Atlas didn't really look that impressed. He looked appreciative, but he certainly didn't dwell on it. He was talking to somebody else at the time, and Mike Tyson just came up for maybe, you know, 15, 20 seconds and said something, and then they shook
hands. He kept his gun in his holster.
This time, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I probably wouldn't be real keen on making up with somebody who allegedly, you know, took out my niece or whatever the hell it was, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
It was kind of made into a bunch of big stories and stuff over the weekend after it happened, but it did, I don't know, maybe I'm being a hater once more, but it didn't seem that significant to me. It was kind of an in-passing type of thing.
All right, so do you want to do a little all-access review? What do you got?
Well, did you catch it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought that, you know, I've... A lot of people know by now that I'm not a big Floyd Mayweather fan. Never have been, never, probably never will be. But, the only reason I say that is because I've grown kind of tired of the Floyd Mayweather reality stuff. I mean, I got tired of it a couple years ago. But it's obviously not going anywhere.
You are a big LRB fan.
Oh, I'm a huge LRB fan. You don't even know. I got the LRB high tops. Oh, yeah, trust me, buddy. I'm a huge LRB fan. But this episode of All Access was actually pretty good. I'm not going to lie. It was entertaining. There were a handful of actually genuinely funny parts. So, yeah, as far as the Floyd Mayweather reality, you know, TV stuff goes, it was pretty good. What did you think of it?
Well, I'm inclined to slightly disagree. I just think that... For one thing, to me, it felt like much more of like a promotional, you know, one of those fluff pieces that they play before the pay-per-view starts than where 24/7, even though obviously it had the same kind of intention, it kind of masked itself better as more of a documentary series. And, you know, a big part of the problem is that Floyd's interviews have just gotten so stale, where he basically says the same thing about every opponent in the lead-up to every fight, and he has the same sound bites and the same kind of pre-rehearsed shtick. You know, there was a couple good moments. Obviously, Canelo riding bareback, you know, shirtless along the horse on the beach was pretty sweet. And, you know, the other thing that stuck to me was the clips from the Mickey Bay, John Molina fight, where I think you really, you know, this is the problem with Floyd, is he's so caught up in this character that he plays, you know, on all of these shows, you don't really get to glimpse the real guy. But I thought in that moment when he went over and congratulated Molina, I think that was genuine. And, you know, while Ellerby's over there just raving and acting like an ass and trying to overturn the decision and all this stuff, you know, Floyd accepted it and went and congratulated the guy. I thought that was really classy of him. And I think, you know, that's a moment that kind of shows a different side of Floyd than what we're used to seeing, which was interesting. But that was only, you know, 45 seconds of the show. And a lot of it was these interviews. And the same thing with Canelo. And, you know, a lot of it was just going through the press conferences and just each guy saying, you know, I'm going to win this fight. But I think Canelo presents himself very well, you know, a lot better than guys like Victor Ortiz and Robert Guerrero did in this situation. You know, I think he really believes that he's going to win this fight. And I appreciate his confidence and his demeanor, and he, you know, I think he's doesn't have the appearance of somebody who's rattled at all.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I think that it's kind of tough at this point. I think that it's a tough sell to present an opponent for Floyd Mayweather, and you know, have it be somebody who, and I mean, obviously Canelo Alvarez doesn't really fit the bill of someone who's unknown. Like a Robert Guerrero. I mean, to the general public, nobody knew who Robert Guerrero was. But at least there's some idea, I think, with Alvarez that, you know, oh, he's that redheaded Mexican kid. I mean, that might be kind of, you know, childish or whatever, but that is how a lot of people remember him. So, but I think that it's kind of a tough sell to make, you know, showcasing his opponent or trying to make, you know, making his opponent interesting is tough. It's going to be a tough thing to do. So that said, yeah, I mean,
right. And I think that there's things about Canelo that can stand out from the other opponents that he's fought recently. But I don't know if this particular episode did the best job of kind of you know, showing that, because I think a lot of it was just kind of like standard sound bites that you would see in the promotional tour. And as part of the problem is the first 10 minutes were all just clips from the promotion, or, you know, from the like press tour, which is all just a bunch of pre-rehearsed, pre-packaged. I mean, it was kind of interesting when Floyd finally kind of, you know, turned heel a little bit in the Los Angeles press conference, I think the final one, and started, you know, kind of smack-talking a little bit. But, you know, up till then, I mean, it's all just kind of, it's not really giving you any kind of insight or real glimpse into, but that can change. I mean, this was the first episode, but I wasn't particularly blown away by it. Yeah, and I mean, I think that, I did think that Barry Pepper, the narrator, kind of fell short of the Schreiber gold standard.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to beat Liv Schreiber in that role, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, like, I'm not even sure if it was an improvement over Common. Because at least Common was distinct, you know, I mean, yeah, he was terrible, but Pepper, it's really, just, you know, he sounded so similar, it was just kind of like a poor man's Liev Schreiber. And I don't think you can underestimate, you know, the role that Schreiber plays in those 24/7s. I mean, that voice, it just gives a gravity to the situation that, in my mind, was kind of missing, and this just felt like kind of a Golden Boy, you know, promotional fluff piece, but... I mean, the first episode is probably the hardest one from a production standpoint because, you know, you have to think about how you're going to introduce this big event and try to get people hooked into it. And I'm also interested because you remember the Guerrero all-access numbers were really bad. And I haven't seen yet what the ratings were for this first episode. I'm guessing it's better than that, but I'm curious how much better this episode did versus the Guerrero episode, because that really was an omen for what probably turned out to be really disappointing pay-per-view numbers that we've heard could have been less than 900,000 buys, but we're probably never going to know the actual number.
No, especially if they were low, we're probably never going to know. But no, that's a good point, too. You know, I'm curious about how well it did myself, but you pretty much pinpointed the two moments where I think I actually laughed out loud were when LRB was actually just, you know, going apeshit ringside during the John Molina Ricky Bay fight, and then Canelo on horseback. Those two parts were cracking me up pretty good. But yeah, I mean, I'm also actually kind of curious to know whether or not the episode was available in Mexico, because I actually haven't asked or anything like that. I really have no idea, or whether there would be all
that's
that much interest in it, because it's kind of the Floyd Mayweather show, you know. So I don't
well,
know
I like
if there would be a ton of interest in it. But
yeah, I like that Showtime puts them on YouTube for free. I mean, that's a smart move. There's no reason why you should hide that for Showtime subscribers. I mean, you're trying to get, you know, pay-per-view buys.
Oh, yeah, it's only going to boost interest if you make it free and, you know, let anybody watch it. It's not going to do any good to, you know, keep that away from people.
Yeah,
but,
and our
know,
boy,
yeah,
but... I was just going to say, our boy Sled Skills had a good point about not enough Roger and Senior in this episode. I mean, they really have always been kind of the most interesting Mayweathers, just because Floyd, you know, even on his best days, he's kind of a bland guy. You know, I mean, he talks a lot of I mean, it was funny the first time, and then, you know, I thought the Mayweather hat in 24/7 was really good. But a lot of that was kind of the quirkiness of the Mayweather family and the different relationships. And, you know, Roger's always good for some good quotes. And Floyd Sr. kind of did one of those, you know, a lame little poem. But, I mean, I could watch those. I would prefer to watch those guys over Junior and Ellerby all day.
Yeah, well, I will say that I was a little bit surprised that they featured Canelo as much as they did. I mean, he's only half of the fight, but, you know, these types of Floyd Mayweather reality things are pretty much the Floyd Mayweather show, you know, shows. And so, yeah, I think
Canelo demanded that pool scene after seeing the Chavez 24/7.
Got to up the ante. Well, you know what another factor is that I'm kind of interested in, and I brought this up when it had happened, because I was interested in whether or not the Time Warner-CBS feud would wind up affecting this whatsoever, and the answer seemed to be kind of, you know, not very clear. I don't really think anybody knew for sure, but the consensus was that it was going to, you know, get resolved within a few days, and here we are like a month later. and there's still a feud going on. So I know that there were, I saw a handful of people say that I wasn't able to watch it, or I haven't been able to see Showtime for a bit, and I've had to do streams or download or whatever. So I think that, you know, if that does wind up affecting the pay-per-view, how much it will affect it? Eesh.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point, because, you know, I think a big part of that Mayweather-De La Hoya success came from 24/7, because, and, you know, just if you have HBO and they're showing it all the time, you eventually you stumble across it, even if you're not a boxing fan. And it was such a good show at the time, and different than anything they had done, and just more extensive. And Mayweather's personality then, it was kind of the first, you know, real mainstream spotlight on him, and it was still fresh. You know, that captivate a lot of people, and word of mouth, I mean, that show was really well received, and I think that contributed to how big that event turned out to be. And here, like you said, I mean, if you can't get Showtime, you're not going to stumble across that show. Now, if you're a boxing fan, I mean, you can find it on YouTube and watch it, but you're probably already going to order the pay-per-view anyway. So if anything, it hurt. I mean, it doesn't help, but I know that you don't need to, you can still order the pay-per-view even if you don't have Showtime.
I would imagine so. I mean, that would be my thought anyway.
I think you definitely can, yeah.
Well, there you go. So, you know, although I will say that, you know, big pay-per-views that expect to get, you know, large numbers are helped by the, you know, general populace and not just hardcore boxing fans who probably comprise a fairly small percentage of those buys.
Yeah, and I think it's gonna get a ton of coverage on, like, ESPN the week of, and people are going to know that it's happening, and it's still going to do big numbers. But, you know, I mean, you're looking at, you know, if you're 10% swing, I mean, that might be 200,000 buys. It's a lot of money.
Well, I will say that, you know, kind of going off what you were saying a minute ago, that, you know, boxing finally seemed to capitalize off of that reality TV market that they were trying so hard to do with you know, Oscar De La Hoya is the next great champ, or I think that's what it was called. And then, of course, The Contender. And, you know, I don't think that either of those quite panned out exactly how TV executives and folks in boxing had hoped. But they kind of did capture that a little bit in 24/7, and I hope that that continues on, because I actually like HBO's take that they're doing now with the, I think it's called 3 Days, you know, where it's like kind of shorter segments of, like, they
yeah,
do for,
two days. 2 days.
2 days, yes.
You
two
added
days.
A day.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess it's 50% better than I thought, but I liked what they did, you know, after the Golovkin-Rosado fight and stuff like that. I like that take because it's not a huge commitment in terms of time, but it's still kind of, you know, it's interesting, especially with Golovkin because he's a beast.
Yeah, it is, and I wish they could turn those pictures with Golovkin and Marquez, just give those guys a reality show or something, you know?
Yeah.
Just the two of them traveling the world.
Yeah, that would be kind of nice. Hey, just throw Matisse and Maidana in there. I don't know how much. I don't even know if cameras can capture that much testosterone at once.
I might have to rock that Matisse haircut.
That was solid. That was really New Kids on the Blockish, and I like it. What
yeah,
else
that was
we
a
got
good
going
one.
On?
He is a man of few words.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, if a guy's going to hit that hard, and if he's going to do the stuff that he does, then I'm not going to begrudge him a funky haircut. Lord knows I've had plenty in my time.
Not at all. So what would surprise you more, Danny winning or Canelo winning?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say that I would probably be more surprised by Canelo winning because I think that, you know, it's kind of the hype is kind of rubber banding just a little bit with Matisse Garcia, where I feel like I'm seeing more and more people picking Garcia, even though there still aren't a lot. But I think that's kind of valid too, because Matisse, and he's often compared to Golovkin for this reason, but he's a hard puncher and people like that, and people like the way that he's been approaching his fights lately, and then he had the big win over Mont Peterson, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that there's kind of just a general tendency to maybe overrate that just a little bit. And so that said, I think that that is actually a fairly more even fight than Floyd Canelo is. So if Canelo were to somehow, you know, grab a win, and I'm not entirely sure that he would get one by decision, and probably be by stoppage. So if that happened, I would be genuinely surprised. Not that I don't give Canelo a chance, but I think that his chance is a little bit smaller than Danny Garcia's. What's your take on that?
I think the smart logic is to say that it would be more of a surprise if Canelo wins, but I feel like the reaction would be crazier from, you know, the crowd, and we're obviously on Twitter, so we're seeing those guys, you know. I think that would get more shocking. If Garcia knocked Matisse out, I mean, it would just go apeshit. And I can see a scenario where if Canelo gets the win and it's kind of like a tentative type chess match type of fight, that maybe is kind of close, and Canelo gets kind of a, you know, a slightly controversial decision, or a fight people think maybe could go either way. You know, that kind of thing, maybe just because it's taking place over 12 rounds, by the end of it, you know, it won't get quite the same shock value as if we see a knockout. Because I don't know, I just don't see Canelo, and I think that Mayweather-Canelo fight's going the distance.
Yeah, I think that that's
either
probably,
way.
You know, if you were going to bet the over or the under, I'd probably bet the over.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm kind of thinking if Danny wins, it's going to be in a really shocking kind of dramatic fashion. I don't think he's going to be able to do what, you know, I mean, the fighters who have gotten decisions over Matisse is just a much different style for one, and also Matisse has kind of evolved and gotten better since then. But those are quicker boxer, you know, kind of boxer types. I don't see Danny being able to do that against him, but I do think it's possible he could just land a bomb and maybe, you know, hurt him and possibly get a stoppage. But, you know, we haven't really seen Matisse hurt. I mean, the guy's walked through huge punches in some of his fights. So,
and you know what's actually kind of crazy about that, about not really seeing Matisse hurt, is, you know, I've been obviously paying attention to, you know, his career. It's kind of tough not to when he's been fighting the level of opposition that he's been fighting for a couple of years now. But he does this move that I've noticed him do a number of times, and he actually even did it against Juan Peterson, where he dips down, and he just basically leans forward, and it looks like he's just going to kind of stand there. And so then what his opponent does is they start throwing because his head's just right there. And he kind of just, like, lets himself get hit with whatever and launches a left hook. And, you know, he's caught a number of guys doing that. So I was kind of just looking at that move because I was watching one of his earlier fights today. I'm just thinking, damn, if he catches Danny Garcia with that, it's going to be game over.
Yeah, and you can kind of envision that Garcia could catch Matisse with the same left hook that he hurt Khan with, and or Morales with, and Matisse would walk right through it.
It's hard to visualize.
I mean, if you just think about it, it's just hard to, like, visualize Matisse getting knocked out by him. But I can see some weird situation where maybe Floyd has a fight like he had against Cotto or against De La Hoya, but it's a little bit closer. Most people think Floyd win, but it just goes the other way. I mean, we've seen crazy stuff, you know, and look at Tim Bradley getting the win over Pacquiao. And I think the one thing here in Canelo's benefit is that the promoter doesn't really have any incentive. You know, I mean, like, what does Golden Boy do? I mean, if Robert Guerrero, if it's a close kind of decision and Robert Guerrero gets the win over Floyd, you know, he's not a real marketable star. I mean, Canelo's the guy they want to turn into the future of the company. So just in, you know, and I'm not saying there's anything crooked going on beneath the surface, but, you know, I mean, sometimes it's like the promoters of the event, the powers that be, maybe there's that subtle influence toward judges, and I don't think, you know, and Mayweather has gotten, like, a lot of, you know, he does what he does, and the judges usually appreciate that. But I think here, you know, Canelo is going to at least be on an even playing field with him, and if you know, you could see the judges swinging some close rounds his way.
So basically what you're saying is that there's more incentive to give Canelo type a decision over a Robert Guerrero type, which I would agree with.
I think that he will get more of benefit of the doubt from the judges. I mean, because you look at these judges, and, you know, a lot of these guys are older, you know, 70-year-old dudes who have been judging for 30, 40 years, and, you know, it's hard. It's just hard to imagine them staying alert and 100% focused every second of every single round. Now, some rounds are very, like, obvious and easy to score, but it's those rounds that are a little bit closer. I just think that Canelo is going to get more of kind of the benefit of the doubt in certain play, you know, and the judges. Like, if they swing a close round to Floyd, they may swing another close round to Canelo. Whereas I think most of the time Floyd fights, if it's a close round, but Floyd kind of had the edge, they give it to Floyd.
Well, what they need to do is bring those volleyball chairs. You know, those lifeguard chairs.
Yeah, they need to get a 15-foot chair and get a better view. For sure.
Yeah, that's exactly.
But you know, it's kind of like the stars in the NBA getting like the benefit, you know, getting some calls from the referees that are close. I mean, you always kind of favor the stars. The one thing that annoys me about Floyd fights is I felt like the CompuBox stats are always so heavily skewed in his favor. And it's not that he's definitely a brilliant fighter and very accurate and very economical, and he also doesn't get hit much. But there, it just seems like sometimes, I mean, I'm seeing these fights, and then it's like the stats are like Floyd, you know, 30 out of 50, his opponent 2 out of 70.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, I think that that's just kind of his style, too. I mean, obviously, but...
I'm just saying, the perception of Floyd, he gets the benefit, like, when it's a close thing, it's like, you assume that he blocked it, you assume that he missed it. You know, when it's like a quick punch that kind of gets through the gloves, you give him credit for the punch, you know, and that kind of thing. And the perception of him being so dominant definitely helps him in the eyes of, like, broadcasters, CompuBox, and judges.
Well, I think that it probably does on some level, but at the same time, there are, you know, a lot of people say the word hater, and more often than not, I kind of just, you know, throw up on myself when I hear that word. But legitimately, though, I think that Floyd Mayweather's personality and style also lead to a little bit of backlash against him, too. So, but regardless,
yeah.
I think that your point probably stands more clearly, because the point is that he is being given decisions and he is being given credit for punches that maybe, you know, aren't super clean, but
yeah, and I mean, I think he's deserved every decision he's gotten, including the first Castillo fight, which I personally have always thought that he edged a little bit. But it's just to say that there's a lot of close rounds in every fight, and there may be three or four close rounds that, when not much happens, I mean, you're giving Floyd the benefit of things that are very subtle that you don't necessarily see.
For sure. No, I think that's a valid point.
And I don't think judges will be that inclined to just automatically give him a close round if Canelo maybe did something. I mean, and you look at Canelo's fight against Austin Trout, it kind of went the other way. I mean, Canelo got every single close round, and they valued his three or four clean punches over maybe more consistent work that Trout was doing. But so it's just, you always have to worry about judge. I don't know. You know what I'm kind of getting at here. I mean, it's just, you always have
no,
to worry about the
for
if
sure.
It's a close fight. What are the, you know, are the judges going to lean toward one guy? And that's why the Pacquiao Bradley decision was so shocking, because you think if anything, they would have leaned toward Pacquiao, and we didn't even think that was that particularly close. But you know, it's shocking to see the superstar not get the benefit of the doubt here, or in that fight.
Well, I mean, I don't want to switch gears too sharply, but I was going to actually ask you, because this talk about, you know, guys getting the benefit of the doubt reminded me, did you get a chance at all to see the Arthur Abraham fight from this past weekend?
I knew that he fought, and I read the story.
Well, I mean, going in...
Did you think that he lost the fight? I guess the recap that I read made it sound like he kind of just got a close decision.
I mean, I thought that, dude, there were really, honestly, probably about maybe 3 to 5 rounds that were close, and a big reason why they were close is because I don't know why Arthur Abraham's style has kind of seemed to erode the way that it has. And really, going in terms of name value, like, it wasn't really the type of fight that you were salivating to watch even going in. So the fact that you didn't watch it is not really that crazy. But basically, he took on a guy with a, you know, somewhat peculiar name, and I'm not even sure how to pronounce his first name, but I guess it's Wilberforce or Wilberforce, Shihepo. And basically, Arthur Abraham has just been doing this thing for this last handful of years where he walks forward with his arms high, and he kind of just throws maybe, I don't know, 10 to 20 punches around kind of whenever he feels like it. And that's what he did here, too. You know, his defense isn't particularly good. He complains when he gets hit to the body that every body shot is low. You know, and that's just kind of like his style lately, and that's essentially what he did. And the other guy took advantage of it, and I thought that Schiaffo could have taken like a, you know, 7-5, you know, type of win. It was fairly close, but I kind of got the feeling that Abraham should not have won the fight.
Yeah, I don't really have much interest in Abraham anyway, you know, prior to this. I didn't even know that he was fighting until I read the recap of it, to be honest. I mean, I think he's just about done on the real world-class level.
And, well, somehow he's marketable, you know, like he's still marketable in Germany, so he'll probably keep fighting, but, you know, yeah, I think that on the world-class level, you know, against just about anybody at 168 pounds that's world-class, I don't see him winning. Not at this stage.
So there was another interesting one that I read that, did you read about HBO offering $3 million plus dollars for Andre Ward, Edwin Rodriguez?
No, actually, I missed that blurb.
Oh, so I saw that, and I saw that Rodriguez's cut was $800, and Ward was going to get somewhere over $2 million, and I guess the Rodriguez camp didn't want it. But it kind of brings up an interesting, you know, because we had talked about Ward before trying to fight, like, Caleb Truax. He's in a real kind of problem here as far as, you know, he may just have to get pushed into doing the Frotch rematch.
Well, that's kind of the way that it's looking right now, because at the end of the day, he's not fighting. And
I mean, Rodriguez is an intriguing opponent, and he's coming off of a huge win. But I think most people would still heavily favor Ward in that fight and probably not think it was real worthy to be getting that kind of a price tag on it.
Yeah,
but, you know,
I mean,
Ward's in a weird spot because he's like the HBO number one guy. He's their best pound-for-pound fighter, and they're trying to market him into something. And he's had these injury problems, and he had a great win over Dawson, and then he went out of the ring for over a year. So, and then, he wants to take these tune-ups, and they're not going to approve that, and they try to put something together for Rodriguez, which I guess is kind of intriguing. But, you know, he's kind of running out of options here.
He's been really inactive, and not just on this layoff right here, but he's had a couple of other layoffs, and even when he's quote-unquote busy, he's not that active. So, you know, the way that he wants to get paid and the way that he wants to negotiate, I mean, on one level, yeah, he's the champion and he's the guy to beat at 168 pounds. But at the same time, if you're not visible, then how can you make yourself into somebody who can command things like that? And I just don't see it. You know, there's the whole issue about, you know, people saying they don't like his style and don't enjoy him. And I mean, I personally am not a huge fan, but, you know, setting that aside, the bottom line is he needs to fight. And he's not. And he doesn't have anything on tap either. So, you know, sooner or later, he might just get pushed into the Frotch rematch.
And, you know, for a while when Showtime made the deal with Golden Boy, I mean, I was kind of saying, all right, chill out. You know, like, there's still the best fights of the year were on HBO. Bradley Provodnikov, Rios Alvarado. But, and then, you know, they had a decent card last weekend with Giel and Barker and the Kovalev Cleverly fight. But at this point, I mean, Showtime is kind of starting to pull ahead. You know, it seems like there hasn't really been a great HBO show in a while. You had those two really good cards, I think, where they were both in March, or maybe one of them was in April. You know, and Golden Boy and Showtime are just putting on, you know, some pretty significant stuff here. And obviously now leading up to the biggest event of the year, it's too bad because I really like HBO's boxing team, and I love Lampley and Kellerman, and I think they still have, you know, great production. And this is kind of ties in with them making such a huge offer for Andre Ward. I mean, they've kind of, you know, put their money with guys like Ward, and Donaire now is lost, and you know, Rigondeaux they don't want back on the airwaves, and it's like they're in kind of a tough spot here, and filling out the rest of the year, aside from, you know, two pretty good pay-per-view cards, but those aren't on regular HBO. And they probably won't do the same kind of numbers. I mean, I think that Pacquiao, Rios, Marquez, Bradley probably combined won't do what Mayweather and Canelo does. So what do you think about that,
well,
man? I mean, I've always kind of been an HBO guy because of the – a lot of it's because of the commentating team, but also they just had better fights for so long. But now, you know, I think Showtime's kind of pulled ahead there.
Well, I mean, this is kind of a little bit symptomatic of, you know – okay, well, in the mid to late 90s, when HBO seemed to be giving out more exclusive type of contracts to fighters, I think that it really wound up biting them in the ass as it came to Roy Jones Jr. in particular, because they basically started seeing that contract could be, you know, it could be exploited a little bit. And guys could take on mandatories that didn't deserve to be mandatories for millions of dollars and a slot on HBO and be very visible. And, I mean, Roy Jones didn't really pull very great numbers for those shows either. And so I'm a little bit surprised that HBO is still sticking with that kind of basic model of, you know, getting network fighters. And, I mean, in some cases, it winds up working out. It obviously wound up working out with HBO and Floyd Mayweather for a while. But, you know, it just doesn't really seem like a very intelligent, you know, stance to take on it. And as far as being compared to Showtime, I don't really think that there's much of a comparison right now. Showtime and, you know, Golden Boy, as sad as it is to say that, you know, they're kind of together now, I guess, but they've done a really good job of staying visible in the sport, you know, putting together good matchups within their house. And, you know, even though people are talking about the production value this, or, you know, HBO's the you know, preeminent, you know, name in sports as far as, you know, pay cable goes. But I definitely think that in 2013, there's been a shift.
Yeah, it's shaping up to be like a Showtime 9-3 type of decision by the end of the year. But
yeah, it's,
you know, those two pay-per-view cards coming up are both have the potential to be pretty huge. I mean, they're not going to do the kind of numbers, but you know, you still might at the end of the year, the top three or four fight of the year candidates, at least on either of those two networks, maybe on HBO. Because really, what was the Figueroa Arakawa was on Showtime, but I still have that behind the Bradley fight and probably behind the Rios Alvarado rematch too, just off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But I guess just the consistency and kind of giving the network that big event feel that HBO always had, and I like what they've done and bringing in Brian Kenny to kind of man the desk makes it look a little bit, you know, like a bigger deal, and you're bringing in guys like Lucas Matisse, who was just there as an interview guest. They are doing a really good job.
And I was thinking the other night as I was, you know, sitting there and they were opening up the Showtime broadcast where they had, they have Al Bernstein, Paul Malignaggi, and then, you know, just these four guys sitting up here on this pre-show. Those are all pretty, like, really, really solid commentating and color guys. It's as much as I do like Lampley and I love Merchant and, you know, et cetera, it's kind of tough to beat that team. You know, they've put together a really solid team to call the fights, too. So yeah, I mean, I don't really think that there's a clear leader, per se. And, you know, 2014 might be a totally different story, depending on some of this stuff that happens, you know, in the next few months. But as of now, yeah, I think that 2013, for the most part, belonged to Showtime.
It's been pretty amazing because, like, every fight that Golden Boy's put on that we thought looked like kind of a mismatch, and, you know, they've all turned out to be really entertaining cards. I mean, off the top of my head, and reasonably competitive. I mean, fights like Garcia Judah, you know, even Malignaggi gave a good effort against Broner, and I thought that was a pretty entertaining fight. And then, of course, like the Berto Soto Carras card, and then this one, you know, it's, you can't really criticize the matchmaking. I mean, they have put their stars, even if it was unintentionally, they've been in some competitive fights, and in some cases have lost.
Yeah, needless to say, and it's, and also, you know, while HBO is kind of, you know, taking the step to expand into China, And while I don't think that's a bad idea, and we've talked about it in the last few weeks and also previously because of Zhu Shuming, you know, that said, Golden Boy and Showtime have taken kind of the opposite approach so far. You know, they haven't really expanded too far into the UK yet. But so far, I mean, like doing shows at Barclays with, you know, local or more local type of fighters that would have a lot of fans that could, you know, come live and cheer their guys on. We've talked about that a lot on this show. Going back to the roots of local type of fighting and matchups that will bring in people. And so there's also something to be said for that, too, I think. Actually,
yeah, definitely.
There was
definitely
something else. What was I going to ask you? Oh, that's right. I was going to, speaking of Showtime, Showtime is this Friday going to be having a heavyweight fight between Seth Mitchell and Chris Areola. And so,
that's
yeah,
a week from Friday, right? Or actually, didn't that get moved to a Saturday?
Oh, yeah. Did it get moved because of the...
I think so.
You might even be right. Yeah, you might be right.
Chavez fight got canceled.
Yeah, you're right.
Or but I'm still happy to talk about it. I mean, I think Areola is going to pretty much destroy him.
Well, what basically brought it up in my mind was that, like, you know, with Deontay Wilder and, you know, there's no clear emergence of the heavyweight division in 2013. And, I mean, I don't really think there really will be, at least not anytime soon. But at the very least, it seemed to have made the heavyweight division more interesting than it was previously. So, I mean, I think that in itself, and you know what, I just looked, and you're right, it did get moved. Yeah, well, whatever. Anyway, we'll talk about it for a minute anyway. But yeah, I thought that was kind of an intriguing fight, although I think that Areola is, he should be favored. He's definitely got more experience, and I think that Seth Mitchell has proven to be kind of fragile. Yeah, but regardless, I think that it is an intriguing matchup that they've put together over between guys who are not quite at the top, but might match up well.
I think that Areola is going to kind of walk right through him. But Mitchell in the past has looked like he's, you know, if anything, a decent puncher, and Areola's been hit. So, you know, maybe there's a chance that something kind of interesting happens. I mean, Ariel has been down a couple times, but he's got a ton of heart, and he also, I think, has a pretty good chin. So I just don't see Mitchell. You know, Mitchell looked so kind of tentative against Jonathan
Banks
in the rematch. Yeah. and you know, he just looked a lot different after being knocked out, and I don't know if it was necessarily better. And Banks had such a lethargic effort, you know, it was tough to judge. This seems like he's just going to be entirely out of his depth, and I think Areola is going to have a pretty easy time with him. So, you know, I guess if you...
Well,
and I don't particularly want to see Mitchell get knocked out or hurt, because I think he seems like a really good guy. But I think that the Banks fight revealed that I just don't think the boxing thing is going to go where he wanted it to. I don't think he's going to be on the highest level. I don't think he's going to have many more big paydays. This could be kind of it for him.
Well, and actually, that's kind of what I wanted to ask about Areola, too, is, you know, I know that he's not old. I want to say he's like 31. But
right.
Still, I mean, he has kind of gotten a couple of opportunities to rise to the top of the heavyweight division. I mean, I'm not going to hold losing to Vitaly Klitschko against him. You know, he basically got just totally worked in that fight, but he might not have been ready for it. Maybe he would not ever be ready for it. I really don't know. But, you know, past that, you know, there's the loss to Adamek. And, you know, and he also hasn't really looked great in a handful of fights, despite, you know, getting a lot of shine for being an outspoken guy, a Mexican heavyweight, or a Mexican-American heavyweight, I should say. And so, you know, do you think that if Chris Areola didn't win this fight, do you think that he, I'm not talking about retiring, but I'm talking about going to the top, do you think that that would be about it for him?
If he loses to Seth Mitchell?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. yeah, I think that would be pretty bad, and it would be hard to regard him as a serious, you know, contender. And I don't know if, you know, winning the fight really makes him a top contender. I mean, I think we've kind of seen him against the best, and we just saw him against Bermain Stivern, and he lost pretty soundly and decisively, you know. But that doesn't mean that there's not a place for him, you know, where I think he fits in somewhere kind of in the back ten of the heavyweights. And I think, if he does what I expect him to do against Mitchell, he's going to continue to at least be getting, you know. But he's also a guy who it's like seems like, I don't know, if you know, he's the kind of guy you could see him just kind of disappearing for a year or two. But if he keeps on fighting, then I think he's going to be right in the mix. He'd be a great opponent for somebody like Deontay Wilder. And there's, you know, other guys that he'll continue to kind of be a headliner and get big fights. But I think he's probably always going to fall short. I mean, certainly against the Klitschkos, but even against, you know, fighters maybe just one step below them.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, it's kind of tough to really sort that out in the heavyweight division because, as we've talked about before,
there's
second rate.
Right, but I think there's other fighters who have already kind of elevated themselves above where Areola is. I mean, obviously not the least of which is Stivern, who just beat him. But there's other guys who are coming up who are unproven. And, you know, I mean, I think a guy like Areola could be a nightmare for somebody like Brian Jennings. I think he would be a huge test for Deontay Wilder because, you know, he's just relentless and he's had experience against the highest level. And
for sure.
So is similar to what Tony Thompson did against David Price. I mean, these are guys who they fell short when they had their biggest opportunity, but it's not, you know, there's a lot of guys who won't be able to beat them and who they're going to be really interesting tests for. But I don't think that that's the case with Seth Mitchell. You know, he just would need to have dramatically improved to be competitive with Areola in my mind. But, you know, we've seen so much wacky stuff this year. Who knows? maybe he's probably going to knock Ariel out or something.
Yeah. No, I tend to agree. And I think that, Tim Starks just tweeted me that he thought that matchup was one of the more, daring matchmaking decisions of 2013. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that he's meaning on Seth Mitchell's part because...
Yeah, I think so.
That's obviously a risk. You know, needless to say, that's a risk because Seth Mitchell, as I've said, has looked a little bit fragile. And while, we were just talking about Deontay Wilder, do I think that he would take on a Chris Areola at this point right now? Probably not. So I do think that there is something to be said for that Seth Mitchell was forced into the matchup. I don't know. I wasn't there. But regardless, you know, I think that he should be given some credit that, you know, it's either shit or get off the pot in terms of finding out whether or not he's going to be able to compete at the top at heavyweight. And so I respect that.
I think it's a really tough matchup to take. And, you know, if they wanted to play it safe, I mean, maybe they could have taken Mitchell back a level and you know, let him fight, you know, to try to develop more over another period of time, like another year, and then try to bring him back on this kind of level. I mean, they really are throwing him right in there after a pretty unconvincing effort against Banks. And also, you know, I mean, that fight got such a bad reception. Maybe that was part of the motivation for it. But, you know, ultimately, I mean, Mitchell had to sign off on it to make it happen. So you got to give him credit for that.
Yeah, definitely. For sure. And like you had said earlier about that Mitchell-Banks rematch, I don't even really know what to take from that with Jonathan Banks. You know, I respect the guy, especially for what he did in the first fight. And, you know, I respect the story behind him and basically having to, take some form of control with some of the Kronk guys, but after Emmanuel Stewart passing, but that was just such an abysmal effort. I don't really even know what to take from that fight, you know, in terms of applying it to another matchup. I'm not sure. But I will tell you who does have an opinion on that matchup. My wife actually wanted to say who she thought would win that matchup. Seriously.
Go ahead.
My tits!
She just said her tits. She was supposed to say Mike Tyson. She totally blew that joke. It was terrible. Yeah, that was bad.
Yeah, it was muffled anyway, so I heard nothing.
Yeah, that's all right. Well, let's see. What else?
I thought you said Martinez.
Well, that would have been equally nonsensical and ridiculous, but what else is going on this weekend? I think that Ricky Burns.
That could be an interesting fight.
Well, and
but
I
think again, that's the following weekend. That's next weekend.
Dude, am I just totally screwing up my dates here?
There's nothing. Because
I had this all. Oh man, I just dropped the ball. This is my Friday night fights.
In fact, what are you going to do without boxing to watch this weekend?
Oh man, I don't know. I'm probably just going to have to do a lot of. No, I won't be doing anything at all. Drinking.
Drinking heavily.
Yeah, just drinking heavily. Wow, I totally fucked up the dates on that, apparently. All right, well, then I do have something else to talk about then. Apparently, according to Golden Boy Promotions matchmaker, I think his name's Eric Gomez, Adrian Broner versus Marcos Maidana is supposedly very close to being made. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about it kind of briefly before, but I think it was more in terms of it being a bit of a pipe dream. Because, you know, I don't think that a lot of us felt that that fight would even really get made. And so, obviously, just because it's quote-unquote close, it doesn't mean that it's going to happen. But this is the first we've seen of it actually, you know, coming close to fruition. So, Broner, Maidana, your call.
I love it. I think it's a great fight. But, you know, I'm going to have to favor my boy Broner. I just think he's really does have a special kind of ability in the ring, and he's so quick and he's strong, and I think he will be able, you know, you look at what Devin Alexander did to Maidana. I mean, I love Maidana. I mean, I would think it'd be awesome if he could catch Broner with a huge punch and hurt him and just kind of make it interesting, because we haven't seen that with Broner. We really haven't seen him get hit. He looks, you know, he's one of those guys, he looks like he would have a great jaw, because he's got this, like, huge head with, like, a very small neck. But we haven't seen that. And he's fighting, you know, fighting against a big power puncher. A guy, and the guy's used to fighting lightweights and Paulie Malignaggi. And Maidana's going to punch a lot harder than anyone he's faced. So I think it's a really interesting fight. I think it's I like both the guys as fighters. You know, I think it's possible Broner could have a chip on his shoulder, because I thought he really cleanly beat Malignaggi. And somehow still didn't really get any credit for it. I mean, I think people expected more from him, wanted him to get the knockout. And I thought Paulie really fought, you know, an inspired fight, like I said before. He did a lot to kind of try to score points. But I just didn't think it was that effective. I think it's the kind of fight that had Mayweather been in a fight like that, done exactly what Broner did, most people would have that like a 9-3 fight, you know, and there would be no argument. And that's kind of what I was going for, you know, talking about with perception earlier. I mean, I think Broner is not well-liked. He's, you know, just kind of a raving maniac on Twitter. He says a lot of really distasteful things. And, you know, a lot of people felt like he got kind of got lucky against De Leon to get that decision. But, you know, against Paulie,
right,
I just thought he, you know.
James,
he was
real quick.
Go ahead.
Real quick, how misogynistic is Broner? On a like 1 to 5 scale, like 1 being like a Sean Connery, you know, where you're allowed to hit a woman every so often and shake the shit out of her, 5 being Ike Turner. Go.
The Sean Connery 77 Playboy interview, I believe,
yeah,
you're referring to.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
I think he's somewhere somewhere on the wrong side of 2.5 on that one. You know, he's it's hard to say, man. I mean, the guy's just an idiot with no filter, and who knows what he's doing on Twitter. He'll probably go with, like, did you read about that guy who was, he was going all the, like, cannibal chat rooms, and he was talking about, like, eating people and stuff, and his wife found out, and he was arrested for, like, plotting to, like, murder and eat somebody. I mean, and his defense, of course, was like, that was just fantasy. So, you know, people on the – who knows what he's doing on Twitter? I mean, he says all sorts of just dumb stuff that he probably thinks is funny. I don't remember, like, reading anything about him actually being in trouble for like, abusing women. Has there been such an incident?
No.
I mean, it seems like something like that is – based on his Twitter, you would think that that's, you know, an inevitability.
Know,
but you just don't know, man. I mean, he says so much goofy stuff. He definitely, you know, like we talked before, the whole lead up to Paulie and Adrian, it was just kind of a for two guys with slightly, you know, effeminate monikers, there was a lot of anti-women, anti, you know, anti-feminist, very misogynist rhetoric. So I'm gonna give him a two.
Well, it's the you know, all day long tweeting about bitches ain't shit and like this and that. I mean, aside from it just not even really being funny anymore, it's almost like funny because it's so sad. I mean, this is like the
new sad Keanu meme. It's not funny. I mean, I'm not trying to like make light of it, but it's just, you know, I don't know. I mean, what can you say?
It looks like
a train wreck waiting to happen.
Yeah, of course, you know, I wouldn't make light of it if he actually did, you know, hurt somebody. But, oh, man, it's like rampant. It's crazy.
Well, he's a nutcase.
Yeah,
well, I mean, I think that's another reason people, you know, I'm just judging him as a fighter in the ring, and I think he's looked really impressive, and even including the Malignaggi fight, I think he showed a lot of his skills and what he can do. And Maidana's like the perfect opponent for him right now. I'd like to see what he does with Maidana. I'd like to see him, you know, if he can get past that.
Fight
that makes
sense.
Khan, Devin Alexander, the winner of that could be an intriguing fight. You know, you got Lucas and Danny in the mix, and all those guys are kind of vying for the huge shot against Floyd. So we're going to get to see these fights, and we'll be able to tell how good people really are. But, you know, if there's one guy in that group, just real quick, like, because Matisse has looked so, you know, invincible the last, like, his recent run, and he hasn't fought great opposition, but what he did to Lamont Peterson and just the way he's done what he's been doing, I think if there's one guy in that group that seems like has the kind of talent and speed and everything that would be needed to, you know, really decisively beat Matisse, I think Broner would be that guy.
I think that that's the type of style contrast that we're looking at. Although, you know, I mean, as we've talked about before, like when we previewed and recapped Broner Malignaggi, I mean, I thought that was a very clear win for Adrian Broner myself, despite, you know, not being a huge fan. It's just, that's just how I saw the fight. I just didn't see Malignaggi being that, you know, effective, because he wasn't that effective. But, you know, that's the style contrast we're talking about with Adrian Broner versus Marcus Maidana, you know. So, yeah, I mean, that's an intriguing fight. It's easy to make because they have the same promoter and their career trajectory seems to be meeting right in the middle right now. Let's see. Oh, and actually, before we headed out on the show, I did want to ask you, I saw a news blurb the other day. I think it might have actually even been on Bad Left Hook about Lucas Matisse and Tim Bradley sparring together ahead of their fights. Bradley, of course, is going to be fighting Ruslan Provodnikov.
Yeah, yeah.
And Matisse, Garcia, etc. So, do you think that is the type of sparring that, you know, helps either guy particularly in terms of the style that they're going to be facing?
I'm concerned for Bradley's health.
I'm concerned for Matisse's eyebrows, man. I'm really hoping there's no, like, you know, cuts or headbutts or injuries or anything like that in that sparring.
Yeah, well, a lot of times it seems like you hear that two really high-profile fighters, which these guys are, I mean, they're close to the top of their divisions, and are sparring each other for big fight. It kind of has the feel of more of a publicity stunt type of deal. It's hard to imagine that Bradley's going to go, you know, full force, let a guy like Lucas Matisse, that they're really going to go after each other in sparring when they've got fights. I mean, what Matisse's fight is in 3 weeks. I mean, I'm not really that concerned for Matisse getting hurt just based on the styles, but I don't know. I mean, if they are using each other to train, I think Matisse could help Bradley a lot. I don't know about the other way around. And, you know, stylistically, they're not really similar to the opponents that they're fighting. So I'm not really sure what to make of it. You know, I don't see Bradley fighting like Danny Garcia. I don't think that Matisse really fights like Marquez. So, you know, maybe it'll help Bradley take a punch, but I don't know if he needs to learn how to do that at this point. You know, so...
Yeah,
it would be interesting.
Well,
I'll tell you what, man. Have you seen that footage of Matisse sparring Sergio Martinez? I always thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I did see that, and I saw it, I'm pretty sure it was on YouTube, probably pointed out somewhere else. But, well, I mean, I think that Tim Bradley, well, I mean, a number of the facets of his game are kind of underrated. I think that one thing that is fairly clear is that he has quick hands, and I think that if nothing else, you know, that might give Matisse a decent look at a guy with, you know, quick hands. Although, how much is that going to help him against Garcia? I really don't know. But yeah, I mean, I just figured it would be interesting to talk about two kind of high profile guys heading into high profile fights, getting into the ring together in training. That's, you know, it doesn't really seem to happen all that often, at least not publicly these days. You know, a lot of times guys basically have like teams of people that they spar with. But yeah, anyways, well, we're almost out of time. So I just wanted to say thank you once again to Mr. Detloff for heading on the show, and please check out his and Eric Raskin's podcast, Ring Theory, and also check out badlefthook.com that James writes for, and queensberryrules.com that I write for. Thank you, everybody, and we'll probably see you next week. Take it easy.